Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we bring you a lecture by Nobel laureate Amartya Sen. Professor Sen is Boston University's first visiting professor at the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future. During this academic year, Professor Sen is delivering a series of lectures on the future of identity, which explores questions that arise from the way people define themselves in terms of group membership. Professor Sen won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1998 for his contributions to welfare economics in the areas of social choice, welfare distributions, and poverty. Tonight's lecture is entitled Globalization and Solidarity. Here now is Professor Amartya Sen.
The world in which we live is both remarkably rich and astonishingly impoverished. There is unprecedented prosperity in the world. The massive command over resources, knowledge, and technology that we now take for granted would be hard for our ancestors even to imagine. But ours is also a world of extraordinary deprivation and of staggering inequality. An astounding number of children are ill-nourished and illiterate, as well as ill-cared and needlessly ill. Millions perish every week from diseases that can be completely eliminated, or at least prevented from killing people with abandon. The world seems to be firmly divided into regions of manifest prosperity and those of great penury. That's another feature of it. And also between the great beneficiaries from the progress of science and technology and those who get extremely little from that progress. The severity of the global divide does not inspire great confidence in the power of global solidarity. If we're really so close, then how come we are so distant? This skepticism is well reflected in a particular form in the rhetoric of the so-called anti-globalization protesters. Based on the thesis that global relations are primarily antagonistic and adversarial rather than mutually supportive, it is natural to ask for reduced globalization, indeed be anti-globalization, in the interests of the underdogs of the world. In that perspective, being pro-poor goes very well with being anti-globalization. But is this really a good reading, a sufficiently probing assessment of the nature of globalization and its implications? I would suggest that it's not, and that there is a serious misdiagnosis here. But it is also extremely important to be clear why this is a misdiagnosis, precisely what is wrong with it. The rejection of the anti-globalization rhetoric need not, and indeed does not, establish the wisdom of a no-nonsense pro-globalization position either. For one thing, we need to scrutinize not only the nature and demands of globalization seen as an isolated phenomenon, but also the characteristics and consequences of institutional features and practical arrangements that have tended to accompany the expansion of global relations. Indeed, I shall argue that the analyses presented by both anti-globalization warriors and pro-globalization proponents need substantial scrutiny and emendation on the basis of a wider appraisal of globalization and its associative features. How does the question of identity, with which this series of lectures is concerned, come into all this? It comes in naturally enough, I would argue. Indeed, group loyalties and affiliative relations are central to the economic, political, scientific, cultural, and ethical features associated with the expansion of global relations and cross-border encounters that characterize globalization. Also, just as business relations create communities of its own, so that scientific interactions, cultural attachments, and other interpersonal interconnections. In this lecture, I want to examine first some historical features of increasing global relations, then examine the economic implications of global arrangements, particularly in the contemporary world. The demand for justice, then the anti-globalization protesters' voice, involve, of course, global ethics. I shall go on to those ethical issues only in the fifth lecture, I'm afraid, in this series, which will be given in April, because I have to do things one by one. But they also involve a certain reading of history, that is the rhetoric and the arguments and the approach of anti-globalization protests. They also involve a certain reading of history and, of course, a particular understanding of economics. I will try to discuss both in this lecture. Globalization is often seen as an expression of westernization of the global economy. Indeed, those who take an upbeat view of the phenomenon see it as a contribution of Western civilization to the world. In fact, there is a nicely stylized history that goes with this straightforward reading. It all happened in Europe. First came the Renaissance, then the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. And this led to a massive increase in living standards in the West. And now, those great achievements of the West are spreading to the world. Globalization, in this view, is not only good, it's also a gift of the West to the world. The champions of this reading of history tend to feel upset not only by the way this great benefaction is seen mistakenly as a curse, but also the way the West's bestowal to the world is undervalued and castigated by an ungrateful world, rest of the world. Like all good stylized stories, this one too has some truth in it. But there is a good deal of fantasy as well, on which more presently. There's another, in some ways an opposite story, which also receives attention. This sees Western dominance as the devil of the peace. In this view, contemporary capitalism, driven and led by greedy and grabby Western entrepreneurs and businessmen in Europe and North America, have established rules of trade and business relations that do not serve the interests of the poorer people in the world. In making criticism of globalization, its narrowly Western character is often given a prominent role, and sometimes globalization as seen as a correlate of Western dominance, indeed a continuation of Western imperialism. While different parts of the anti-globalization movement have different concerns and priorities, the resentment of Western dominance certainly plays a very significant part in many of these protests. There's clearly an anti-Western element in many parts of the anti-globalization movement. And the celebration of non-Western identities of various types related to religion, such as Islamic fundamentalism, or region, such as Asian values, or culture, such as Confucian ethics, can add fuel to the fire of anti-Western sentiment. But is globalization really a new Western curse? I shall argue that it's not a new Western curse. Indeed, it is in general neither new, nor necessarily Western, nor indeed a curse. Indeed, globalization has, over thousands of years, contributed to the progress of the world through travel, trade, migration, spread of cultural influences, and dissemination of science, knowledge, and understanding, including that of advancement of technology. These global interrelations have often been very productive in the advancement of different countries in the world. And the active agents of globalization have often been located very far from the West. To illustrate, let me look back at the beginning of the last millennium rather than the beginning of the present one, where we are. Around 1000 AD, global spread of science, technology, and mathematics was changing the nature of the old world. But the dissemination then was, to a great extent, in the opposite direction to what we see today. For example, the high technology in the world of 1000 AD included paper and printing, the crossbow and gunpowder, the clock and the iron chain suspension bridge, the kite and the magnetic compass, the wheelbarrow and the rotary fan. Each one of these examples of high technology of the world a millennium ago was well established and extensively used in China and was practically unknown anywhere else. Globalization spread them across the world, including to Europe. A similar movement occurred in the Eastern influence on Western mathematics. The decimal system emerged and became well developed in India between the 2nd and the 6th century, and was used extensively also by Arab mathematicians soon thereafter. These mathematical innovations reached Europe mainly in the last quarter of the 10th century and began having its major impact in the early years of the last millennium, playing a significant part in the scientific revolution that helped to transform Europe. Insofar as anything can be said about the identity of the agents of globalization, that identity in this case is neither exclusively Western nor European, nor indeed linked to Western dominance. Indeed, Europe would have been a lot poorer economically, culturally, and scientifically had it resisted the globalization of mathematics, of science, of technology at that time. And the same applies, though in the reverse direction from west to east today. To reject globalization of science and technology on the ground that this is Western influence and imperialism would not only amount to overlooking global contributions drawn from many different parts of the world that lie solidly behind so-called Western science and technology, but would also be quite a daft practical decision, given the extent to which the whole world stands to benefit from the process. To equate this phenomenon with Western imperialism of ideas and beliefs, as the rhetoric often suggests, would be a very serious and costly error, in the same way that any European resistance to Eastern influence would have been at the beginning of the last millennium. We must not, of course, overlook the fact that there are issues related to globalization that do connect with imperialism, actual imperialism as it existed. The history of conquest, colonialism, and alien rule over Africa and Asia remain relevant today in many different ways. But it would be a great mistake to see globalization primarily as a feature of imperialism. It's much bigger, much greater than that. Indeed, in resisting the diagnosis of globalization as a phenomenon of quintessential Western origin, we have to be critical not only of anti-Western rhetoric, but also of pro-Western chauvinism that one can find in many contemporary writings. Certainly, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the Industrial Revolutions were great achievements. And indeed, much of the action there occurred in Europe and later, of course, in America. And yet, many of these developments drew on the experience of the rest of the world, rather than being entirely segmented and confined within the boundaries of the discrete Western civilization. Indeed, our global civilization is a world heritage, not just a collection of disparate local cultures. Just to give an example, when a modern mathematician sitting in Boston invokes an algorithm to solve a difficult computational problem, she may not be aware that she is helping to commemorate the name of the Arab mathematician Al-Khwarizmi, algorithm the word derives from Al-Khwarizmi, who flourished in the first half of the 9th century and worked most of his life close to Baghdad. There's a chain of intellectual relations that link Western mathematics and science to a collection of distinctly non-Western practitioners, of whom Al-Khwarizmi, more fully Muhammad ibn Musa Al-Khwarizmi, was one. In fact, the term algebra is also derived from his famous book, Al-Jar wal Muqabila. Indeed, Al-Khwarizmi is one of a very large group of contributors from different non-Western societies, Arab, Chinese, Indian, and others, whose works influenced European Renaissance and later the Age of Enlightenment, and ultimately even the Industrial Revolution. West, of course, must get full credit for the remarkable achievement that occurred in Europe and Europeanized America. But the idea of an immaculate Western conception is an ahistorical fantasy. Not only is the progress of global science and technology not an exclusively West-led phenomenon, there were major global developments in the world in which the West was not at all involved, not even as a recipient initially anyway. The idea that the West, even if not the exclusive originator of global progress, has been invariably a major player in every global game must also be strongly resisted. As an illustration, consider the important event, very important event in world history, of the printing of the first book in the world. It was a marvelously globalized event. The technology of printing was, of course, entirely the achievement of the Chinese, as I mentioned already. But what about the content of what was printed? In fact, the first printed book was the Sanskrit treatise in Buddhist philosophy, Vajracchedika Prajnaparamita Sutra, sometimes referred to as the Diamond Sutra, translated into Chinese from Sanskrit in very early 5th century. It was printed 4 centuries later in 868 AD. The translator of this Sanskrit sutra, Kumarajiva, was half Turkish and half Indian and lived in a part of eastern Turkestan called Kutch, but later migrated to China. All this, involving China, involving Turkey, involving India, is globalization all right. But the West is not at all in sight. In fact, the misdiagnosis that globalization of ideas and practices have to be resisted because they entail Westernization, dreaded Westernization, has played a very regressive part already in the colonial and post-colonial world, including in the post-colonial literature. It incites parochial tendencies and also undermines the possibility of objectivity in science and knowledge. Indeed, it is not only counterproductive in itself, it can also end up, given the global interaction throughout history, as a good way for non-Western societies to shoot themselves in the foot, even in their precious cultural foot. Consider the resistance in India to the use of Western ideas and concepts in science and mathematics. In the 19th century, the debate between Orientalists and Westernizers in India fitted into the broad controversy about focusing either on Western education or on indigenous Indian education, seen as a dichotomy that the British Raj had to choose between. The Westernizers, quote-unquote, such as the redoubtable Macaulay, saw no merit whatsoever in the native Indian tradition. As he explained, I quote from Macaulay, "I've never found one among them, advocates of Indian tradition, who could deny that a single shelf of a good European library was worth the whole native literature of India and Arabia, unquote. Written, I might say, in Trinity College, of which he was a member. Partly in retaliation, the advocates of native education resisted Western imports altogether. Both sides, however, agreed on something. They accepted the foundational dichotomy. But given the deep interrelations between culture and civilizations across the world, this was bound to produce some very awkward classificatory problems. Let me illustrate with one. The illustration is provided by the arrival in India of the trigonometric term sine, like sine, cosine, tan, and so on, directly from Western trigonometry. It came straight from the British, and while seeing it as a yet another example of Anglo-Saxon excursion into an undermining of Indian culture, the genesis of the term was not in fact traced to its Indian origin, which in fact it does have. The migration of the concept and terminology is also a very interesting step-by-step thing to follow to understand how globalization of science and ideas occur. The 5th century Indian mathematician, Aryabhatta, to whom I'll come back in the next lecture, in the third lecture, including Arab commentary on his writing, which is also a feature of globalization. The 5th century Indian mathematician, Aryabhatta, had discussed the concept of sine in the 5th century, in his contemporary writings, and he called it Jia Artha. Jia is chord, Artha is half. From there, the term moved on in an interesting migratory way. And I quote from Howard Eaves' History of Mathematics to describe its geographical movement. So I'm quoting now Howard Eaves. Aryabhatta called it Artha Jia, half chord, or Jia Artha, chord half, and then abbreviated the term by simply using jia, chord. From jia, the Arabs phonetically derived jiba, which followed Arabic practice of, and following Arabic practice of omitting vowels, it was written with the consonants only, jb. Now, jiba, aside from its technical significance, is a completely meaningless word in Arabic. Later writers who came across JB as an abbreviation for the meaningless word jiba substituted jaib instead with the same consonant, JB. So they called it jaib, which contains the same letters and is a good Arabic word meaning cove or bay. Still later, Gerardo of Cremona in 1150, when he made his translation from the Arabic, replaced the Arabian jaib by its Latin equivalent, sinus, meaning a cove or a bay, from whence comes our present word sine, unquote. Given the cultural and intellectual interconnection, the question of what is Western and what is not is often very hard to decide. Both Macaulay and his Indianist opponents may have to shuffle their shelves quite a bit to come to terms with the world's globalized history. The polar opposite of globalization would be persistent separatism and relentless autarky. It is interesting here to recollect an image of seclusion that has been invoked with much anxiety in many Sanskrit texts, beginning from about 2,500 years ago, that is about 500 BC. It's quite amazing how often this has been repeated. I know of 4 users, which I'm going to mention, but there may be more. This is the story, quite a fetching story, I think, of a well frog, Dukupa Manduka, who lives its whole life within one well and is suspicious. I know those only inside things, inside the well and nothing else, and is very suspicious of everything outside it. As in fact, Ganapat explains, the frog has a world view, but it's a world confined to the well. So beginning from about 500 BC, there are at least four Sanskrit texts that I know, and there may be more: Ganapat, Hitopadesh, Prasannaraghava, Bhattikavya, that warn us not to be well frogs. The well frog does, of course, have, as I mentioned, this perspective, but that perspective is confined to that little well. The scientific, cultural, and economic history of the world would have been very limited had we lived like well frogs. We certainly need to resist the well frogs, and I might add the attorneys of well frogs, who are often very eloquent. It may be argued, however, that in this lecture, so far I'm concentrating far too much on the globalization of science and literature, and not enough, indeed, so far not at all, about the globalization of economic relations, particularly the problem created by the modern global economy. What about them? It could be said, all right, the point you're trying to make about science and literature and culture may well be right, or may not be, but that's not what we are concerned with. Not quite true, because people are concerned quite a lot of the rebellion of the Western ideas, especially in a variety of literature, from local communitarian literature, post-colonial literature, as well as religious or fundamentalist literature, actually targets not just the economy, but in fact the concepts, the ideas, the ways of thinking, and science and literature generally. But what about economics? Let me begin here by noting that the importance of global contact and interaction applies to economic relation in much the same way. And the penalty of being a well frog is no less there. This can be brought out by the history of trade and commercial contacts. But let me concentrate not on the history, which I could also do, because that's also had a very long history, and in the printed version of the book I'll go more into it. But what about the modern global relations on which many people tend to concentrate? There is much evidence here, too, that the global economy has brought prosperity to many different areas on the globe. Pervasive poverty, nasty, brutish, and short lives dominated the world a few centuries ago, with only a few pockets of rare affluence. In overcoming that penury, extensive economic interrelations, as well as modern technology, have been very influential, and they continue to remain extremely important today. What has happened in Europe and America and Japan and East Asia has important messages for all other regions in the world. And we cannot go very far into understanding the nature of the global economic problems today without first acknowledging the positive fruits of global economic contacts and its massive promise. Indeed, the economic predicament of the poor across the world cannot be reversed, I would argue, by withholding from them the great advantages of contemporary technology, the well-established efficiency of international trade and exchange, and the social as well as economic merits of living in open rather than closed societies. Rather, the main issue is how to make good use of the remarkable benefits of economic intercourse and technological progress in a way that pays adequate attention to the interests of the deprived and the underdog. That is, I would argue, the constructive question that emerges from the anti-globalization movement. It is an important question, but constitutively it's not a question about globalization at all, and the linkage with globalization is only instrumental and contingent. What then is the main point of contention? The principal challenge, I would submit, relates in one way or another to inequality, international as well as intranational inequality. The inequalities that irk concern disparities in affluence and also gross asymmetries in political, social, and economic opportunities and power. The issue of inequality relates centrally to disputes about globalization. A crucial question concerns the sharing of the potential gain from globalization between rich and poor countries and between different groups within a country. It is not adequate to understand that the poor of the world need globalization as much as the rich do. It is also important to make sure that they actually get what they need. This may require extensive institutional reform, and that task has to be faced at the very same time when globalization is defended. There's also need for more clarity in formulating the distributional questions that have to be asked. Indeed, I would argue that this issue has been thoroughly messed up by the reputation of half-baked arguments on both sides. It is argued on one side that the rich are getting richer and the poor poorer. This is, in fact, by no means uniformly so, even though there are cases in which this is exactly what's happening. Much depends on what indicators of economic prosperity are chosen, which regions we concentrate on, and the answers that emerge do not speak in one voice. The attempt to base castigation of economic globalization on the thin ice of the hypothesis that the poor are uniformly getting poorer produces a peculiarly fragile critique. On the other side, the apologists of globalization point to their belief, and often the fact, that the poor who participate in trade and exchange are not typically getting poorer. Since they are getting richer through being involved in the global economy, ergo, the argument runs, globalization cannot be unfair to the poor. They too are benefiting. The two sides can then end up in battling over a question that is hard to settle and that is not actually the fundamental issue anyway. It is in fact not adequate to ask whether the poor are getting poorer or richer. Even if the poor were to get just a little richer, this need not imply that the process is moving adequately fast, or that the poor are getting a fair share of the benefits of economic interrelations and of the vast potentials of globalization. Nor is it adequate to ask whether international inequality is getting marginally larger or marginally smaller. The basic concern is the massive level of inequality, not whether it is also getting a little larger or a little smaller at the margin. In fact, it's rather hard to have a clear picture of the trend of the global economic inequality for reasons which I've just briefly mentioned. Much depends on the period selected and the indicators chosen. The variables in terms of which inequality and poverty are judged makes a big difference. And also, it depends on the groups that are identified, since their fortunes have varied. But the more important point is that this debate about marginal trends does not have to be settled to get on with what is really the central issue, to wit, to recognize and deal with the massive levels of inequality and poverty that exist, indeed characterize the contemporary world. Even if the patrons of the contemporary economic order were right in claiming that the poor in general had moved a little ahead, the compelling need to pay immediate and overwhelming attention to appalling poverty and staggering inequalities in the world would not go away. And to rebel against inequality or protest against unfair sharing of benefits of global cooperation, it's not necessary to show that this massive inequality or distributional unfairness is also getting marginally a little larger. The central questions have often been rather clouded by over-intense debates on side issues, to which both sides in the dispute seem to have contributed. When there are gains from cooperation, this is quite central to the argument here, There can be many alternative arrangements that benefit each party compared with no cooperation. So there are different positions that you can go to, each of them beneficial to each party. It is necessary, therefore, to ask whether the distribution of gains is fair or acceptable, and not just whether there exists some gain for all parties, which can be the case for each of these large collection of alternative arrangements. As J.F. Nash, the mathematician and game theorist, discussed more than half a century ago, 1950s, a paper published in Econometrica in 1950 called The Bargaining Problem, a paper, by the way, which was cited by the Royal Swedish Academy when he, as a mathematician, got the Nobel Prize in Economics for the relevance of his mathematical work for economics. And one of the two primary contributions was this one we are talking about. He was discussing in the presence of gain from cooperation, the fact that the central issue is not whether a particular arrangement is better for all than no cooperation, since there are many such alternatives, but whether that was a fair division of the benefits. The criticism that the distributional arrangement for cooperation is unfair cannot be rebutted, as it often is, I'm afraid, by the apologists for globalization, and I've seen quite a lot of this expressed in very reputable publications, cannot be rebutted by just noting that all the parties are better off than would be the case in the absence of cooperation. That just simply is not adequate. Let me illustrate it with an example. To argue that a particularly unequal and sexist family arrangement is unfair, it does not have to be shown that women would have done comparatively better had there been no families at all, but only that the sharing of the benefits of the family system is seriously unequal in the particular prevailing arrangement. The issue on whether many of the debates have concentrated, to wit, whether the poor too benefit from the established economic order, is inadequately probing, indeed ultimately the wrong question, in much the same way as the sexist criticism of sexist arrangement in the family would be by retorting, saying, if it's so unfair, why don't you live outside families? It has to be asked whether the unfairly treated parties, whether women in the family or poor in the globalized world, whether they could have benefited more and could have had a fairer deal. That is what the fuss regarding globalization is about. It's not just about whether the poor are getting poorer or richer. The use of the market economy is in fact consistent with many different ownership patterns, resource availabilities, social opportunities, rules of operation, such as patent laws, antitrust regulations, etc. And depending on which arrangement prevail, we can get very different prices in terms of trade and quite diverse overall outcomes with varying levels of inequality and poverty. There's nothing revolutionary in this statement. Standard elementary economics. The central question is not, indeed cannot be, whether or not to use the market economy. That shallow question is easy to answer, since it is not possible to have a prosperous world without extensive use of markets. But that recognition does not end the discussion. It only initiates it. The market economy can generate many different results, depending on how physical resources are distributed, how human resources are developed, what rules of game prevail, and so on. In each of these spheres, economic, social, and political institutions have roles to play within a country and in the world at large. The market is one institution among many, and its irreducible importance does not make the other institutions insignificant, even in terms of the results that the market itself, economy itself, will produce. The ability of the poor to participate in economic expansion depends on a variety of enabling conditions, many of them social and societal. As has been amply established in empirical studies, these conditions include education, include epidemiology, include land reform, include microcredit facilities, include appropriate legal protection, and many other means and institutional means on which the empowerment of people depend. The success of the market economy depends on what happens to these arrangements. The demands of economic globalization are not confined only to joining the market economy, freeing the trade and exchange, and all that debate concerned with it, but extend very far beyond that. For example, while forces of competition may drive some traditional producers, just to give one example, forces of competition in a globalized world may well drive some traditional producers out of their customary jobs. There's nothing peculiar about that. That's the way technological progress often occurs. The displaced people can, of course, find other jobs if they're able to enter the globalized economy easily and find something else. But the displaced people cannot easily enter into new productions in the globalized world if they happen to be illiterate, unable to read instructions, or suffer from chronic ill health. And there are many other disabling conditions that we can mention here. In that situation, they can get the stick of the global economy without any of the carrot. Economic globalization is not just about markets. I've been arguing in favor of globalization, but also affirming the legitimacy of many of the questions that the anti-globalization protesters raise. There's a misdiagnosis as to where the problem lies. It does not lie in globalization itself, but in inequality and the inadequacy of institutional arrangements that could change the nature and operation and results of the market economy. The terms of the debate on the global market economy have to be, I would argue, thoroughly changed. If people need enabling social and economic and political opportunities, along with the actual power to enter and use the market, that compound recognition cannot be summarized either by claiming that the market needs our support or by claiming that the market has to be opposed. The overall opportunities constitute an interconnected whole of which the market economy is a part, but there is much else. Since global capitalism is much more concerned with expanding the domain of market relations than with these other enabling conditions, say democracy or elementary education or social opportunities, globalization of markets is on its own a very imperfect approach to world prosperity. Indeed, it's much worse than that. As George Soros has pointed out in his book Open Society, published last year, there's a follow-up which is in the press coming out soon, international business concerns often have a very strong preference for working in orderly and highly organized autocracies rather than in activist and less regimented democracies. And this can be a regressive influence, he argues, on equitable development. Multinational firms can also exert their influence on the priorities of public expenditure in less secure third world countries in the direction of giving preference to those public measures which provide safety and convenience of the managerial classes and of the privileged workers who work in many of these secluded industries over the removal of widespread general illiteracy, medical deprivation, and other adversities of the underdogs of societies. These possibilities do not, of course, impose any insurmountable barrier to development. You can combine these changes along with having a prosperous market economy. They are not insurmountable barrier, but it is important that the surmountable barriers be diagnosed and actually be surmounted. Issues of inequality raise questions about global arrangements and not merely local and national ones. The argument here is presented with amazing brevity and remarkable diagnostic simplicity. So I quote from the preface in the book Culture Matters by Sam Huntington. In the early 1990s, I happened to come across economic data on Ghana and South Korea in the early 1960s, and I was astonished to see how similar their economies were then. 30 years later, South Korea had become an industrial giant with the 14th largest economy in the world, multinational corporations, major exports of automobiles, electronic equipment, and other sophisticated manufacturers, and per capita income approximately that of Greece. Moreover, it was on its way to the consolidation of democratic institutions. No such change had occurred in Ghana, whose per capita income was now about 1/15 that of South Korea's. How could this extraordinary difference in development be explained? Undoubtedly, many factors played a role, but it seemed to me that culture had to be a large part of the explanation. South Koreans valued thrift, investment, hard work, education, organization, and discipline. Ghanaians had different values. In short, cultures count, unquote. This fleeting argument, I would argue, does not establish really anything about how important culture itself is seen in gloomy isolation. There were many things that differentiated South Korea and Ghana already in the 1960s when they were allegedly described to be similar, including South Korea having an immensely higher literacy rate acquired through massive public education after the Second World War. It's a very high level of illiteracy before the war. It may be tempting to see in these public efforts nothing other than the working out of Korean cultural inclinations. But that would be a hard causal story to sustain, given the fact that South Korea, which had a very high level of illiteracy, like Ghana, had a sharp break in public policy after the Second World War, partly, as mentioned earlier, by explicitly learning from and emulating Japan. And it proceeded to reap as it sowed. There were other institutional differences also between Ghana and South Korea, which, again, were not just a matter of cultural difference. For example, South Korea's class structure, having a substantial and powerful capitalist class, and a government that wanted to cater to the business community, particularly through an ambitious plan to facilitate Korea's entry into the world of global trade and exchange. It's also worth recollecting that South Korea is still learning other things, not what it learned earlier. And it's learning these things rightly. I mean, rightly, it's right that they are trying to learn that. Sometimes the lessons have come from experiences of failure rather than success. The East Asian crisis from 1997 onwards that overwhelmed South Korea, among other countries in the region, brought out some of the penalties of not having a fully functioning democratic political system. When things moved up and up together, the voice that democracy gives to the underdog may not have been immediately missed in terms of airing of grievances. But when the economic crisis came and divided the fell, as they almost always do in crisis, the newly impoverished missed the voice that democracy would have given them to use for protest and to demand economic redress. Also, the fact that South Korea had no social security system worth the name. Democracy became the predominant issue in the politics of economic crisis, along with the recognition of the need to pay attention to downside risk and to economic security. There was a global lesson here too, to wit the special contribution of democracy in helping the victims of disaster and the need to think not only about growth with equity, the old Korean slogan, but also about downturn with security, because you will have downturns from time to time. And of course, Korea had proceeded to learn this lesson very quickly with the democracy being the election, electoral issues on which Kim Dae-jung was elected, and these debates are very active, of course, now. Of course, culture does matter. How can it not? Since culture can influence what we want and how we behave. In the last lecture, I argued that civilization and culture, while important, need not be the principal, not to mention unique identity, in categorizing the people of the world. And in the earlier part of this lecture, I discussed why a culturally fragmented reading of the history of globalization does not actually work. In a similar vein, I would like to end, therefore, this discussion, which I've just finished, by saying that culture need not be the principal determinant of all our achievements and failures, including economic success and deficiency. The world in which we live is thoroughly interdependent and not discreetly fragmented.
You've been listening to a lecture by visiting professor and Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen of Boston University's Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website, World of Ideas, visit our website,